Okay, but we're gonna move quicker today, more quickly, because one of the responses that we'll be seeing is like 10 pages. But before we go to that, I have interesting things to show you. I want to show you some videos first. Let's see. First thing I want to show you is just because we sort of mentioned it before, something related to it. My son sent it to me about 30 seconds from his yeshiva. I think you'll find it interesting if you don't have children in yeshiva there, what they're doing and how they're having davening. And you'll see with the plastic, and you'll see one of the Rosh Yeshiva, how he's like locked in this box. But the reason I'm showing you is not that. Is I want you to see the davening. This is a Rosh Chodesh davening. This is the sort of thing that when I went to yeshiva, never in a million years would you have this, and with a guitar and this and that, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I think he would have gone, been very upset to see what I'm going to show you now. But it shows you how there's different types of yeshivas, and even though this is a yeshiva in the Old City, all right, where they do, I mean, they do have Gemara and everything, but I want to show you this first. This is the first video I'm going to show you. If it's on, I will. It. So pay attention to this. So I think that's quite interesting. That I mean, that's a Rosh Chodesh davening with a guitar. As I said, when I was in yeshiva, no one in a million years would have thought that that's considered appropriate. I want to show you now another video because I mentioned. Oh, actually, before I get to the videos, I listened to the this morning to the class last week. We spoke about Shmuel Ashkenazi. I forgot to mention the thing that he's most known for. Many of you probably know this. Here you go. The Otzer Roshei Tevos. This is everyone has this book. It's by Shmuel Ashkenazi, Dov Yardane. So every time you need to know a strange abbreviation, you pull it up here. He's also known because he's the editor of this work, Haggadah Shleima. Anyone who's interested in serious investigation of Pesach, the Seder, has to look at the Haggadah Shleima. And you see right on the very first page, it tells you Ba'arichat Shmuel Ashkenazi. So oh, okay, two more things I want to show you. Actually, one here, let me pull up the screens. Me get my screens here for you. Okay, in terms of videos, I want to show you. A lot of videos. Okay, first thing I think you'll find it interesting because I also mentioned this. If you're looking for something to watch, there's this guy, Peter Santinello. He goes all over the world and he just exposes his people. You see this hundreds of thousands of views to all different cultures, Ukraine, Pakistan. He did about 13 sessions with the Hasidim. And it's really very interesting. And if you read the comments, it's unbelievable all the positive, the Kiddush Hashem that Peter is making, because all these people writing saying, "I never knew anything about the Hasidim. All I thought were bad things." And but what I found significant is that he actually goes to a Friday night dinner, and the family says that you know took it, we had it was complicated. We had to get a permission from the rabbi to rabbis, I think they say, to let us film this. So he.
Yeah. This like hard
so here you can watch the video. They have the cameramen filming it on Shabbos. I mentioned, which I find astounding, although we've had other examples. There was, I think it was maybe Vishnitz or Bells. They put a camera in there. I don't know if it was actual individuals or just the camera for Yom Tov davening. But if it's okay to video have a videographer there on Shabbos, then next time your son has a bar mitzvah on Shabbos, you can have a videographer also. Maybe they make a distinction. They say, in this case, the Peter is not doing it for the Hasidim. He's doing it for his viewers, so they're not benefiting, but maybe because it's such a Kiddush Hashem, but the fact is, here you have a Hasidic family, and you have the whole non-Jewish film crew in there filming them Friday night. And the other thing I want to show you is... I spoke about non-Jewish songs used for Jewish that are made Jewish. And we know that. We know Mordechai and David. We know classic ones. I mentioned one. Here I have it in front of me. I wrote about it. There's a famous Hasidic song which is taken from a love song. The original love song, it says in German original German, it goes, forest, forest, how large are you? Rosa, Rosa, how distant are you? Wald, Wald, wie groß bist du? Rosa, Rosa, wie weit bist du? And it goes on about, it's all about Rosa. The Kalva Rebbe, this is famous, Hasidim know this. He turned this love song into a religious song. So instead of, so you sing about Golis, Golis, how far are you? And instead of Rosa, Rosa, how distant are you? It's Shlina, Shlina, wie weit bist du? And this is well known among Hasidim, this song. But after hearing this, Rabbi Ari Enkin sent me the following. This is an Ottoman military song. I did not know this at all. But pay attention, you'll recognize this. Now, I don't know where this comes. Maybe it comes through Hungary because that was under Ottoman control. Maybe it's from Eretz Yisrael when we got it. Maybe it's a Sephardic tune. I know nothing. If anyone knows about this, let me know. I think I already, you know, among the Haredim, they often have no clue about songs. At least I mentioned, we talked about the Simon and Garfunkel. I think I even showed you on the Kisei Rachamim, some of their videos, their Torah videos begin as follows. I'll play it again for those who haven't seen it. This is a shiur by Rav Eliyahu Madar, who's actually one of the people in my book. He wrote to me. We mentioned him earlier on. This is how it begins, his shiur on Chol HaMoed. You know, is it everything you need to do know about, because Chol HaMoed, what's permissible and what's not. The Haredim who go with, they don't know, many of them, Israelis especially, they have no clue what this tune is that starts the shiur. I dare say that most of you know what it is. You might say it's a little crazy, put the Torah with that, but then what can I say? Okay, we have a couple minutes. I said to you, ask us, and I'm going to get Baruch, I'm going to get to, I promise, believe it or not, I'll get to the thing I want to show you about Yaakov. I want to show you one more thing before we get to that, though. I said last class, I was talking about Madrid, and I want to show you something I think you'll also find very interesting. Let me get rid of this. So I don't get confused later on. What can you eat in Madrid that we can't eat in America? So I walk into the butcher shop there in Madrid, and there's a sign on the wall that on the butcher shop that, hold on, let me get it for you, that the meat there, they have, it's done with nikor, and it's a smicha from Eretz Yisrael. So what is nikor? Nikor actually has, there's an English word for it. The English word is called porge. This is a word in the English language, but it only means Jewish thing. It means to make a slaughtered animal ceremonial clean by removal of the forbidden fat, etc. This goes back to the 19th century in England. You can look up in a dictionary. This is actually a real word, a Scrabble word you can use as porge, but it only means this Jewish thing that, people assume that you can't eat the hindquarters. Like, I don't know much about beef, maybe some of you, but I know, for example, here you have the tenderloin, the sirloin, the top sirloin, and people assume you can't eat it. It's not true. You can eat it, but you have to remove the forbidden fats. Now, in America, we generally don't do that. although, and some people actually think it's a minhag not to. It's not. It's, you can read Rabbi Zimatovsky's article here. It's today, it's done. You can get the hindquarters in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Moshe has a tshuva on it. He says and when he was in Europe, they had it. It's just that people don't do it because it's difficult and it's easy just to sell it to the non-Jews. But Rav Moshe is clear in his tshuva. If you want to eat it, you can eat it. And as I said, the Rabbanut in Israel, El Gaucho, I had it when I was there. So it used to be you couldn't get it in America. You'd have to go to Madrid or Israel. But I was just looking before. I saw Chabad site. It says technically filet mignon is as kosher as any other cut of meat. And it explains, though, that it's nikor is not so simple. But he says, I believe most slaughterhouses sell the hindquarters of the cattle to non-kosher butchers, but it does exist. And actually, it is now, it's a new trend. I know of two places, at least two. So, for example, there's one place in the New York area called Bistro Kosher, and you can get all the good stuff. Can't get rid of that thing. All the good stuff you want. Who does it? His name is Avidan Elkin. He teaches at YU. It's under the Hashkacha of Rabbi Ben Chaim, and he also is on the Beis Din of Elizabeth, and he writes Gittin there. And then there's another place. Hey, it's expensive. Look what this charges, the beef tenderloin. It's expensive. But there's also a place in Philadelphia called King of Filet. It's under, this is who it's under, Rav Abergel. His son is Elchanan. He's the rabbi in Philadelphia. His father's on the Beis Din of Jerusalem. And I guess this is a Chabad guy. That's a Chabad name. So you can read all about, on the website, about... And you can order if you're interested, if you're a real meat person and you want to get your tenderloin or sirloin, there it is. The final thing I want to do before we begin, they'll ship it to you also. The final thing I want to do is, let me get rid of this, is I told you I would share something with you that I think you'll find of interest about Yaakov and Leah. We were speaking a good deal about it. So here we go. How is it, the question is, how is it that Yaakov didn't know who it was with him on the wedding night? Already, by the way, Josephus mentions that he was drunk. Now, there was an article that appeared a number of years ago in this journal. It's actually an academic journal called Vitas Testamentum, but it's in line with, we'll see, the Mefarshim in a second. But he wants to argue, and he does things I've never thought of before, that there's actually, you can perhaps derive proofs that that was the case from the Pesukim itself. If you look in the Pasuk in Perek, are we here, in 29, when... it speaks of what does Lavan say to him? Hold on. In verse 26, Lavan says, when he wakes up, when Yaakov wakes up and sees Leah, he says, "We didn't do it in our place that you know to give the hatsira lifnei habachira, to give the younger before the older." Now these two words, tsira and bechira, only appear together in the feminine one other time. And that's earlier on in with the story of Lavan, not Lavan, of Lot. And if you look in verse 31 first, you have Habachira and the Tzaira. And that's also a similar case. It's a case of sexual relations where a person doesn't really know what's going on. So the author wants to argue that this is the hint to what's going on here. And further, and that you won't find in any of the traditional commentaries. But then he starts pointing out the word Mishka. What's the whole business with the Mishka? If you look going back in 29, in verse 22, it says that Lavan gathered all his people and made a Mishka. What is a Mishka? Well, if you look in the Sifsei Chachamim on the Pasuk, he tells you, Dasakeni Bali Tosafos, it mentions that Lavan is known as a Ramai, trying to be fraudulent. Why? Because he wanted L'shakeres Yaakov Bayayin in order to trick him. So he wanted to get him drunk. Now, what is a Mishnah? If you look in Parakiotes, and at the very verse, very chapter I mentioned with Lot in the commentary of the Sforno, in Yotes Gimel, it says, what is a Mishnah? Kviya Suda al Hayayin. That the definition of Mishnah means with wine. So all these things, it's possible that that could be the pshat, that there was a Mishnah, and maybe Yaakov, everything wasn't so clear. Perhaps, because al pi pshat, it's hard to figure out what's going on there. One final comment about Mishnah before we begin. In this sefer, which I just got from Rabbi Yaakov Kapel Schwartz, who we were speaking about already, a couple weeks ago, and I told you he has, for a Satmar Chassid, he has some very interesting insights. In volume 5, Likutei Diburim, on page 58 and 59, he asks a very interesting question. Why on Purim do we have a Mishnah, a feast? And why on Hanukkah did Chazal make a decree, Lahodos HaHalel, and not to have a Mishnah? People like to get together on Hanukkah, but there's no inyan of a Mishnah on Hanukkah, but like we do have on Purim. Instead, we have special prayers. And he develops the idea that that before Chazal changed it, everyone, when they wanted to express their simcha for something positive, it was only with a Mishnah, with Yayin. And Mordechai and Esther established it this way because that's what the people did. And he says maybe even the Nevi'im held this. But the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, they're the ones who established that for Simcha, it has to be with Avodas Hashem. Simcha Shel Hodos Al Halal. And very interesting how he speaks about how a Mishnah, how our feelings of joy were transferred to prayer and mitzvah as opposed to Mishnah. It's like Breslovers sing Simcha Mitzvah Gedol Lios B'Simcha. It's a great mitzvah to be Sameach. And what did the Revelvo Soloveitchik say? Not Mitzvah Gedol Lios B'Simcha, but Simcha Gedol Lios B'Mitzvah. It's where we feel great joy when we're in a mitzvah, not that it's a great mitzvah to be in joy. Okay, everyone. Let us now go on. We are continuing in the Sefer. We are on page 261, Siman Kuf Chafchet, and we are returning now to a response to Rav Menashe Klein. Let me get a picture of him again, because this will be the last time we see Rav Menashe Klein in our tshuvot. Here he is. We've spoken a good deal about him. This tshuva, which we're going to see, it is not included in his Mishnah Halachot. I think the reason it's not included, unfortunately, I have to say, is because it deals with Rav Kook and an idea from Rav Kook. I think that's the reason that there's no mention. I checked online. There's no mention of Rav Kook in Rav Menashe Klein's Sfarim. He mentions Mosada Rav Kook when he quotes Ramban, but he won't mention Rav Kook. I think that's the reason. We spoke about Rav Menashe Klein. I told you how impressed I am. What a lamdin, unbelievable lamdin. I also said that there's in yeshiva circles, and Rav Schechter is not very impressed, and in yeshiva circles, they would make a joke that instead of calling it Mishnah Halachot, Mishana Halachot, because they thought that so many of his rulings were contrary to what they should be. Mishana meaning change. Incidentally, if you Google Mishana Halachot, you'll see pretty unbelievably, I guess, slips of the pen. You'll find Daniel Sperber calls it Mishnah Halachot, B. Barry Levy. I don't know what they were thinking that they wrote it, but that you'll see in their books. But the phrase Mishnah Mishana goes all the way back to Rameir Abulafia of Toledo. In his attack against the Rambam, he says as follows. He refers to the Mishnah Torah and he says, Eini yodea im yesh eim lamasoret o im yesh eim lamikra. Which means, I don't know if the Mishnah Torah should be referred to as Mishnah Torah, because he rejects a lot which the Rambam wrote, or Mishnah Torah. So you see this jibe, is it Mishnah or is it Mishana? Goes all the way back to one of the great Rishonim, Rameir Abulafia. Okay, so what does he say here in in this responded to me from 1987 when I was in college. And, you know, I have to say, when I looked at the back at all these letters, it's amazing. I was, and this is just the scholar, the Torah letters. I have a whole, I can publish another volume of just the academic letters. And I have Torah letters and additional Torah letters, which weren't included. I spent a lot of time writing these letters. This goes back to when I was in college. Let me turn off my sound here. But let me give you an introduction here, because there's something you need to know to appreciate this. And that's, we all like to say that, or people like to say that Judaism is different than Christianity, because Christianity has this concept here, you see it here, outside the church, there is no salvation. And this was expressed by many Catholic teachers. You have many Protestants who say that today. What it means is that if you don't accept Jesus, you can't be saved. Can't go to heaven, whatever you want to put that as. And it's often portrayed that, well, you know, we don't have that because we believe that all non-Jews can go to Olam Haba. And we're different than the non-Jews in that we're much more tolerant and open-minded in that respect. And that's usually given, and you'll see at all these different gatherings, people will throw that out as a truism. Well, it's actually, I don't know, can you have a falsism? It's actually a falsism from two sides. First of all, I have to tell you, and I work at a Catholic university, that is no longer the doctrine of the Catholic Church. It is, you might find certain evangelicals who have this idea, but today the church does not say that. What they say is that everyone, you can only be saved through Jesus, but you don't have to be in the church. That is a... someone who has good intentions and a good person will reach heaven. Okay, we don't need to be concerned about their doctrine. But just so you need to know that that's, just so you, if you're interested, that it's not exactly what the church holds today, the Catholic Church, I should say, and most Protestants as well. But what about Jews? Well, it's not so simple either. I want to show you something now, a Rambam. And let me just read it to you. It says, it's in Hilchos Melachim, chapter 8, Halacha Yud Aleph. It says, Kol ha-makabel sheva mitzvos, anyone, we're talking about the non-Jew who accepts the seven mitzvos, v'nizhar l'asosan, and is careful to fulfill them, hareze mechassidei umos olam. This person is one of what we call the chassidei umos olam, v'yeshul chelak olam haba, he has a share in the world to come. The who, and what does that mean? She a kabbalo son, that is, he accepts these mitzvos, the yaseo son, and does them. Mipnei shetziva vahen hakadosh baruch hu batorav hodianu al yedei Moshe Rabbeinu, shebnei noach mikodem mitztavu bahen. But only if the non-Jew does these sheva mitzvos, not because he's a good person or just as a moral person, but he only does it because God commanded this in the Torah and told Moshe Rabbeinu that non-Jews are obligated in this. But if he did it simply because he concluded natural law or whatever, he concluded this is the good way to live, which is pretty much every non-Jew, that they're not doing it because of the Torah. They're not Noahides. You only have a few of those in the world. If you just do it because you think it's the proper way to live, this person is not regarded as a ger toshav. And is not regarded as one of the chassidim umos olam. And is not even regarded as a chacham, one of the wise men, meaning that he has no share in the world to come. This is a bit of a shocking passage for people who don't know, because it basically, you have here the Rambam saying the exact parallel to what we just saw was the old Catholic doctrine, outside the church there is no salvation. Pretty much the same thing. This is the subject, incidentally, of an article, famous article by the late Stephen Schwarzschild, Do Noahites Have to Believe in Revelation? He says it's a passage in dispute between Maimonides, Spinoza, Mendelssohn, and Hermann Cohen. What's the story with Mendelssohn? Mendelssohn, it's because Mendelssohn was so upset with this passage that he wrote to Rav Yaakov Emden. He said, this is unfair. What if the people who live on these islands who never heard of the Torah? And Rav Yaakov Emden basically upholds what the Rambam says. The Kesef Mishnah on the spot, he doesn't know where the Rambam gets this. He thinks it's his own idea, although he thinks it makes sense. However, if we take us back to the passage here, you can actually see that in the note, it points out something different. That in the version of the Yemenites, it says that this person who just observes the mitzvahs because it makes sense is not a chun chesed u'masolam, but the other version is rather he is one of the wise men. He's not a chesed u'masolam, but he's a wise man of the nations, and that's obviously a very good thing to be a wise man. For the Rambam, what is better, being a chassid or being a chacham? You have to look in Hilchos Deos. The Rambam, basically, you want to be a chacham. Occasionally, you know, you can go beyond and then be a chassid, but being a chacham might be better. And if it's not better, it's certainly very good. I mean, chassid might only be for certain special people. And then it points out that this is the nusach in the Mara Malashkar. And it's, he quotes here the Gemara Megillah. If someone says some chachma, even from even a non-Jew, he's called a chacham. So if you say a chachma, you're called a chacham. So presumably, if you figured out that you should observe Torah or observe the Shev Mitzvos on your own, you should be a chacham. And then they cite what they think is the source for this, where it's called Mishnas Rabbi Elazar. It's a midrash, which says that who is one of the people who is regarded as Hasidi Umos Olam? It's if you do it because God commanded this to Noah, but if you do it, then say, I heard it from someone else, you only get your schar in this world. So that could the source. We're not so important at the moment. Rabbi Menashe Klein, as I said, he's a great scholar, and there's all sorts of great stuff in his writings. But there's a lot of stuff that, let me just say that if you're not just in the Haredi world, because they've had their big issues with him, but certainly in the modern Orthodox world, you just can't accept it. Just some stuff which are far out. I spoke about this, with views of women, views of non-Jews, views of converts. There's a lot of extreme stuff in his writings, which is why in the yeshiva world they came up with this expression, Mishana Halachot, but which I would never say, because look, he's entitled to his opinion, even if I feel that we don't accept it. And as I said, the learning in his stuff, in his writing, and he's also he survived the Holocaust. When it comes to the non-Jews, we're going to see next week with the Kaisenberger. You have to sort of, I think, give some leeway for that. And in terms of the women's issue, this really is a reflection of pre-war Hungary, I think. One day I'll publish my article on him. There's so much interesting stuff in him, and you get unbelievable kulas in him. He thinks that a lot of these chumras come from the Balei Tshuva. He doesn't like Balei Tshuva so much, but he blames the Balei Tshuva and the rabbis who are trying to work with the Balei Tshuva. They make things too difficult. In many places, he's a big mekil. And he doesn't like the new orthodoxy that has popped up after the war, because he says, whoever heard of this in Europe? So there's a lot to say about Rabbi Menashe Klein. Someone could really do a whole doctoral dissertation on him. But one of the things that is troubling, at least to me, is that throughout his writings, he's always saying that every non-Jew basically has no share in the world to come. Why? Because the Rambam. He goes, there's no non-Jews who ever observed mitzvot because they were commanded. And the Rambam says, therefore, you have no share in the world to come. So basically, they're all Rishayim. The whole world is Rishayim. It's who wants to go through life when every single person's a Rasha, and you can't deal with pious people who are not of your religion, because we all know they're pious people who are of a different religion. They don't have the complete truth, but they have certain truths. But the Rabbi Menashe says some of the stuff he says is really, really extreme. Okay, so why did I write to him? I wrote to him because he's always citing this Rambam. And I say, why are you citing this Rambam? It's pretty clear, I said, that this is not the correct Girsa. The correct Girsa is Ela Mechachmehem, not Velo Mechachmehem. And I cite the Yemenite text, and the Yemenites have excellent Girsa. They're the best of all the Girsas. The Rambam for them was the authority. And generally, you look in the Yemenite text, the Girsa in everything is, they were very careful on it. And They just copied it without making changes. No, in Ashkenaz, for instance, the Ashkenazic rabbis, they would put their comments on the side. They would sometimes change the text. They change the text so often, the Rabbeinu Tam had to do a chevrim, saying if you change the actual text as opposed to putting on the side, you're in chevrim. But not everyone listened to Rabbeinu Tam. So the Ammonite text, and also Maram Alashkar, and there's other sources that have this different girsa. So I cited the source that in Mishnah Sura Elazar. So he begins as follows. He says to me, "I want to make a comment to you that it's not our way to say that this text is a mistake." That's what I said. I said it's a mistake. Perhaps I shouldn't have said that, but I said that. He says, because we don't have prophecy. Who can say that it's a mistake? What I should have said is it appears much more likely. If I'm not mistaken, Fa'ur supports this Rinashah Klein's text, but all the other scholars and everyone assumes that it's not correct. And he says that what you should say is there's another version of it. Still, From Menashe Klein, I'd expect him to say, though, why does he make such a big deal about this text that he has when we have so many other texts that seem to make a lot more sense? Look, is Aristotle, and Rambam writes about Aristotle that he didn't know Torah, but he reached great heights in understanding. Are we going to say that he's just another Rasha? It doesn't really make sense. We'll see what Mazuz says in a minute. And then he said, and I sent him Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a letter. It's in Igros Rav Kook, volume 1, page 99-100, where Rav Kook says that, of course, the correct girsa is Elam Chachmehem. And Rav Kook develops the idea that a Chacham is greater than a Chassid. And that when we say that a Chassidi Umos Olam have a share in the world to come, that's the lower level. Because the Chachamim, they are able intellectually to figure out on their own the best way to live. The Hasidi Umos Olam, they only do it because they're told. It's what Kant would call heteronomy. Whereas the others, it's autonomy. They've on their own figured out that this is the right way to live. It shows that they've reached an amazing height. It's like we say about Avraham Avinu, that he did certain mitzvos. He was able to figure this out. It shows an incredible development of whether he, because we usually assume he figured it out on his own. He wasn't told through Nevuah. Then on his own, he understood that that's the way to fulfill God's will, even though he wasn't commanded. And Rav Kook says that these people who were able to figure out on their own, for example, that you shouldn't kill and you shouldn't steal, that's on a higher level than those who just accepted this because this is what God says to do. And by the way, the Rambam himself says this. The Rambam says that when he has a problem here, because there's one place where the sages say you're not supposed to say that you're supposed to say, for example, about certain sins. He says, I want to do it, but the Torah says I can't. It's like you're not supposed to say I hate kosher food. You're supposed to say no, non-kosher food. No, non-kosher food tastes good. It's just that we're commanded not to. On the other hand, the Rambam says, doesn't this contradict what you're going to say? I wish I could kill this person, but I'm not going to because Torah says not to. Or I really want to, commit adultery, but I'm not going to because the Torah says, or rape this person. The Rambam distinguishes between like natural laws, which you would know even without the Torah. If you would say that I really want to kill or I really want to steal from this person, but I'm not going because the Torah says I'm not to, that's like a low level. That is a low level. Yeah, it's better than nothing, but you should know on your own that it's wrong to kill and wrong to steal. And that's the whole reason why we assume that people could be punished even though they never were given revelation, like in the days of Noah. These people, they didn't know anything, but they should have known on their own that killing is wrong, stealing is wrong. So all of this fits into a very nice approach that we have and is at odds, by the way, with the Rambam's the version that we have it in the Mishnah Torah. So Rav Kook goes off and explaining how that we don't even need to say about these people that they have a share in the world to come, because of course they have a share in the world to come. They're higher than the people who are just doing it because they're commanded. Tzedakah, by the way, is one. You have some people who say that the only reason we give tzedakah is because we're commanded. If we weren't commanded, why would I ever give tzedakah? But that strikes me as really off, and it's not in line with all the great rabbinic teachers that teach the notion of a natural law. No, you should give tzedakah because it's the right thing to do. The lowest level is the one who says, well, if it wasn't for the mitzvah, I never will give tzedakah, and the only reason you're doing it is because you're commanded. You should do it even if you're not commanded. And the reason we had tzedakah, according to many, it falls into the model of a natural law that you should know on your own intellectually. You should rationally know that it's the right thing to do. So after summarizing this letter, he doesn't say who it's from. He says, Sila Mei Garrett, a copy of a letter. I made a copy and I sent it to him. In my note, I tell you who it is. He says, with all due respect, The Bali Garrett, the person who wrote this letter, it bothers me, you can't even say Rav Kook. The Bali Garrett made a big mistake here. Sharele Mari, may God forgive him. Because even though it says he has a good intentions, he explains that this is incorrect, that the version of the Rambam we have is correct, that just like if a Jew, he says, yeah, the non-Jew has to know he's doing it because it's commanded. And he gives a parallel. He says, just like a Jew, if you decide that you just like every seventh day, you like to rest and you like to not use your phones just because you feel that makes for a healthier life, is that fulfilling the mitzvah? He says, of course not. There's no sorry. You're not doing anything. So same thing with the non-Jews. Of course, the difference is that we're talking about a ritual law like Shabbos, where you would only do it because you're commanded, and a natural law. Rav Kook would say you can't compare the two. The Shev Mitzvah saying Noach are natural laws that non-Jews are able to understand on their own. That's what makes them. What does the Gemara say? You could have learned certain things from behavior of animals. But he goes off and explains that no, it's not true. Rav Kook is wrong. That you have to accept everything. You have to do it because I guess he might say you have to do tzedakah because it was commanded. And then he says, although it's true that if someone says there's chachma b'goyim, there's wisdom among the goyim, he says you have to believe it. That's only chachma which has nothing to do with Torah. But chachma satorah. No, but again, Rav Kook would say to him, the Shev Mitzvahs B'nai Noach are not only from Torah. They're the sort of thing that by definition, you should be able to figure out on your own, even without being commanded. They're a natural law. That's what Rav Kook would say. But Rabbi Klein rejects that. He says, Chas v'Shalom, to agree with what this letter says, that these people have even greater star. And then he doesn't like the source from the Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer, because Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer says that the idea is that you have to you accept that it comes Chassidu Musa Olam is when it comes from Noah, whereas the Rambam says from Moshe. So I don't really have a source for the Rambam per se. So there you see Rabbi Menashe Klein with a really very particularistic, exclusivist view. Rejecting not just Rav Kook, but this whole tradition of seeing the Rambam, not saying that the person who observes the Shev Mitzvos because on his own intellect, not because they're commanded, is not one of the Hasidei Umosom. He's not even one of the Chachamim. So there's more in this letter, another point, but I want to make a detour now because Rabbi Mazuz, who I don't know how many of you knew anything about Rabbi Mazuz, before we started these classes, we're going to have more to say about him in future classes. When I sent him the copy of the book, he gives a Saturday night shiur. And then the shiur is published, his weekly thing. They print about 100,000 copies in Israel. It's the largest weekly shiur in terms of distribution in the world. They even had it in Gerba when I was there printed out. But believe it or not, he dealt with this letter from Menashe Klein in his evening shiur. So I'll tell you what he says. But before I do that, hold on a second. Before I do that, I want to play you just what he says. You can actually see it. It's on YouTube. And you'll see it's a very hard Hebrew to understand, an Arabic sort of Hebrew. And now you have to listen carefully to what he says. He says something about me, which is incorrect, but you're going to derive something interesting from it. So I'll share my screen with you, and I'll explain to you what he says if you can't understand it, because it's not the easiest Hebrew. So this is from, November 30th of 2019. So the book came out in August of 2019. I sent it to him. So just pay attention to what he says, and then I'll summarize it for you. He was speaking about this Rambam. And he was arguing that the only correct girsa is the one Elam Echachmehem, that if you do the mitzvos, the Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, because of your own intellect, you're not Chassidus Olam, but you're one of the Chachmei Umos Olam. So listen carefully here.
Kuskishin. אבל ישנו ספר בדורנו שחבר אותו חכם אחד שהוא מנהל בית מדרש הרבנים באמריקה. אבל הוא ירא שמיים. הוא התכתב עם כל חכמי הדור, כל מיני שאלות שאלו. הוא תלמיד חכם, פרופסור הוא תלמיד חכם, אפשר להיות. בית החסילה התיכונה, בית הראשי תיבות, פרופסור הוא תלמיד חכם. שמו של הספר, גירות מלכי רבנן, מביא כמה מכתבים. ביניהם היה מכתב מהרב מנשה קליין. נדמה לי, זה מחבר ספר משני הלכות, משני אות מנשה. נדמה לי שהוא נפטר. כתב לו שמה, אל תאמר שגרצה ישנה טעות. תאמר, יש גורסים אלא. וכתב אתם, אני גם כן כתוב אלא. אמרו, מה גרסה טעות? אחרי שנתזריחה בספרים, אין מה לעשות. חילה מכבודו. אם היית רואה רבי זלמן, בלי שיש לו שום ספר, לא מראה מלשכר, ולא כתבי תימני, פדה שלא ראה אותה. אומר, מהשכל פשוט מאוד, אחרי הדעת, אי אפשר לומר, מי שעושה אחרי הדעת, לא מחזית אמות העולם ולא מחכמים, אז מה הוא? בימה בשורת אדם? אלא מחכמים, אין סביר לדבר הזה. מה הסוכות האלה? אדם שאומר דבר פשוט, ברור, אמיתי, מתעקש, לא, אני מתעקש.
Okay, so a couple of things. First, before I get to the interesting point, he says, this doesn't make any sense. He says that the Rambam, I mean, how could you say that if you do it because of your own intellect, you're not Chassidim Osolam and you're not Chachmeyam? What are you? He says, Behema B'tzorat Adam? Are you a Behema? He says, of course it's a mistaken gear, so you have to use your, if you look at it, it's clear, it's Pashut, and he explains it. So that has to be. Now, what's interesting is that he said, if you paid attention, he said about me that I'm a Menahel Beit Midrash Rabbanim America. I'm the head, I direct JTS. Where did he get that from? Well, so I wrote to him. I said, I have nothing to do with JTS. Why would you say that? Because he knew I'm a professor. But he wrote back because I'd sent him years before my Saul Lieberman Kuntress. And he saw that, so he thought that I was must be running the seminary because I'm writing all about Shaul Lieberman and things like that. So, but notice he says that he's Manal Beit Midrash Rabbanim in America, but he says Bahu Yirei Shamayim. So at the time, he thought that I was working for the conservatives, but he says I'm still a Yirei Shamayim. This gets us to the old dispute about Lieberman, which when we finish these classes, I'm going to do the Shaul Lieberman, two classes, a whole history of Shaul Lieberman. Some Gedolim related to Shaul Lieberman, like he was one of the Gedolim Yisrael, a Talmud Chacham, a Yirei Shamayim. Others wanted, like Ron Kohler, wanted nothing to do with him. So here you see Rabbi Mazuz, because at this time, he thought that I was involved with the seminary, but he still has no problem quoting me and saying that I'm Yirei Shamayim. But that's interesting. Now, what's this thing about Patach? I'll show you this. Because this is cute. You have to know Tanakh Baal Peh. You have to look it up and everything. He says, he quotes the Pasuk. You see this here in Pasachet? Petach. I think it just came to him. He knows all of Tanakh backwards and forwards. It came to us about it. Petach. He says, Petach Atzela Tichona. That's the door for the lowest row of chambers. So he said, Professor Talmud Chacham, Petach. And then he calls it Petach, or whatever. I'm not saying I'm a Talmud Chacham. He wants to say it, okay, I'll take it. But the funny thing is that this has now become a joke among friends of mine. So a friend of mine just sent me, I don't want to show you his name because maybe he doesn't want to know it, but I'll show you the bottom. Maybe you can see it here. Oops. No. Whatever. He writes to me, Matana lichvod yedidi hayakar petach pei tuff squiggly marks chet, and I have other people who now send me emails. They go to me lichvod yedidi hapetach. So this has become a big joke that in our little world, especially among the Rav Mazuz people, I'm known as Petach. So I guess that could be on my matseva. You can call me Petach. There's worse things to be called. Incidentally, just so you don't think that he does, I'll show you where he mentions me by name, just so you know I'm not under any sort of harem or anything. Here is just a couple of months ago, I'll show you. By the way, they start the weekly shiur with this Arabic music, the old Arabic music. So here, just so preserved for posterity, you can hear my name mentioned, so you know I'm not making it up. Hold on. Hold on. I think it's here. Hold on. Okay, I can't see it now. So, whatever. I thought it was at minute 42. No, actually, no, it's not. It's not minute 42. Hold on a second. Let me just show you where it is. I think you might find this interesting. Reserve it for posterity. Hold on a second. Okay. Let me just show you quickly. Someone wanted to hear it also.
אני יודע שהוא חריף מאוד, לא כתב הערות על שירים, כתב הערות על הזהרות שמגיברו, כתב הערה על פיוטוצי של בודה לוי, אבל כמו שכתב הרמב״ם מורה נבוכים, שלח לי מישהו מאמריקה, רבי אלימלך שפירא שיהיה בריא.
Okay, so there you go, אלימלך שפירא, good enough. I feel very good to hear that because... you know, I think he's like the greatest gadol we have in our time. So in terms of knowledge and breadth, and we're going to hear a lot more from him. So I feel it's an unbelievable zechus that I can point out something and be mentioned and be corrected when people thought it was the big honor when the Rav would tell you, or even Shaul Lieberman, when he'd tell you, you don't know what you're talking about. So I feel... it's a zechus. I don't have that many zechuyos in that, but at least that I have. I think I have a bit of a zechus in that. Okay, the other thing is I want to return to Rav Menashe Klein. So the other thing is that Rav Menashe Klein, I'd sent him, let me back up for a minute. There's passages in the Talmud, not passages, I'll give you, throughout the Talmud, where Chazal cite a pasuk. Just to prove something, like you have to do it this way. So what is that pasuk? Is that pasuk, are they deriving it from that pasuk? Do we have a tradition? And this pasuk is just like a mnemonic or something to remind us? Does the pasuk create the drasha? This is a big dispute. The Rambam says that we have a tradition, an oral tradition, on all these things, or pretty much all these things, or many of these things, and the pasuk is just like a mnemonic device. That is, they're not really deriving that you do X or Y because the pasuk. No, we know it from tradition. This is what you do. The pasuk is just being cited as like to help you memorize it, a siman or something like that. But it does, the halacha doesn't derive from the pasuk. This is a problematic position for many because if you look in the Gemara, it does certainly seem as if they're deriving it from the Psukim. The Ritva, in his commentary on Rosh Hashanah, he says that what we call the Esmachta from a Pasuk, what it is that when a Torah is given, it has the ability to be derived. That is, it's already in the Torah, in potentia, I should say, latent, that this is the meaning. But Chazal had the authority whether to darshan it or not. But the sages have the ability to derive it if they want. And then what does the Ritva say? That this is Baruch the MS, and not like those, not like different Hamafarshim Hasmachtos, not like those who explain Hasmachta, Shehuk Derech Siman. That it's just like a mnemonic device or a sign, but it doesn't actually, it's not really essential to the commandment. Shachoshev Kain Hu Das Minus. Because if you say that, it's a position of heresy. Well, the Rambam says that. So Rabbi Menashe Klein was speaking about it and talking about how the Ritva, and most people assume that the Ritva is attacking the Rambam and saying it's a heretical position. By the way, the Ritva doesn't think that the Rambam is a heretic. This is also important. Among the Rishonim, it's not uncommon for one to say about another that it's a heretical position. We spoke about the Ralbag. They say about the Ralbag's views, it's heretical views. The Ramban says about the Rambam's views, about certain, one in particular, that certain biblical events happen in dreams, that you can't believe this. That doesn't mean that they think, the Ritva doesn't think the Rambam's a heretic. Just because you believe in heretical view doesn't make you a heretic. It's a good position, I think, for our day also. You might find someone who has a position, a view that you think is heretical. It doesn't mean the person's a heretic. That's what the Ritva says. He says it's a das minus, but he doesn't, the Rambam thinks differently. He doesn't think that the Rambam's a heretic. The Rambam holds a view that he thinks is heretical. What I sent Rabbi Klein is that there was a great Gadol. His name was Meshulam Roth. Because he was Mizrahi, people don't know that much about him, but they would have made him the Gadol Dor. He was really an unbelievably towering figure in Meshulam Roth. He wrote responsa called Kol Mavasser. Of course, he has Zionistic type stuff in his tshuva, but he has a kuntras in which he discusses the certain matters, and he deals with this Ritva, and he says this Ritva couldn't have been referring to the Rambam. The Rambam's position, he didn't know about it because it was in the Parish of Mishnah and he didn't have the Hebrew translation. He says it's impossible to imagine that he would have said it about the Rambam. There's other people who could have had this position, Ibn Ezra, others. Rabbi Klein, and I agree with Rabbi Klein, by the way, in this. He says he doesn't see that this is necessarily true. The Rishonim held of this concept, Losa Guru, don't be afraid. That is, they say their minds, and we know, he says, how much the Rashba criticized the Rambam, and therefore there's no reason to assume. He doesn't mention, the Ritva doesn't mention the Rambam by name. And of Kovod, you could say he says that, and the person who says this, it's a das minus, but he doesn't accept this idea. And by the way, if you look in the edition of the Sefer Zikaron of the Ritva, Rabbi Kama Kahana, as I recall, he also says this isn't correct. No reason to assume this. So that's the tshuva of Rabbi Menashe Klein. The next one, we have 5 minutes. We'll see if we get through it or not. It's taking us, it's a long one. We're going, we're not going to go through all of it. It's 12 pages. It's from Menachem Chacham. He's someone we mentioned already. Not a well-known rabbi. Was the rabbi in Or Akiva in Israel. It's not really a significant place. But he wrote interesting books, and he's one of the people I corresponded with. So I think there's 3 or 4 letters from him. Because after he responded the first time, I wrote him another again and again. And this appears in one of his Tshuvot, Volume 7, Zahav Menachem. I feel it's a great zechus and a great honor. Here is someone, he doesn't know me other than through correspondence, and yet he writes a 12-page letter to me, 13 pages actually, 13 pages, which must have taken him a number of days. How often do we write letters to people we don't know, putting such effort into it? I understand it's Limud Torah, but he can do Limud Torah other ways. It's a, as I say in the preface, I'm very thankful to all them who took the time and effort to write to someone who they didn't know from Adam. So what were my questions? While I have time, I'll introduce you to the questions. We'll get to the answers next week. The question was simple enough. The Rambam says as follows. Let me show you the Rambam. The Rambam in the laws of Rotseach, the laws of murder, Perek Dalet, Halacha Test, says as follows. Although there are other sins that are more serious than murder, they do not present as serious a danger to society as murder does, even idol worship, and needless to say, incest or violation of the Sabbath. See, this is the Chabad translation, and they translate arayos as incest. That's not the correct translation. Arayos, incest, is included in it, but so is adultery for the woman, or a man with a married woman. That's also included here. Generally, this is a good translation, by the way, but this is incorrect, incest. Because you'd see this, you say incest, and then you say gilearios, it's not included. So he says, even idol worship, and needless to say, let's say sexual immorality or the violation of the Sabbath, are not considered as severe as murder. For these sins involve man's relationship with God, while murder also involves man's relationship with his fellow man. So he's telling how bad murder is. Murder is worse than gilearios, and it's worse than and Shabbos, and it's worse than Avodah Zarah. But then, if that's the case, what does he mean when he says, although there are other sins that are more serious than murder? He says, Afal pi sheyesh avonos chamurim, mishvichu stamim. You just told me that murder is worse than Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shvichu Stamim. But you said in the previous paragraph that there are sins that are worse than murder. Let me read it to you what he says. There are sins more serious than murder. They don't present as serious a danger to society as murder does. So what is it then? What's worse than murder? That was the question. The other question, since we just have 2 minutes, I'll tell you the other questions. The other questions are quick. We'll get into them as well. One's easy. Erasing God's name on like a computer. This is at the beginning of the computer era. You write God's name on your computer. Can you erase it or not? That's going to be a simple one. The next one is not so simple. We'll get back to it next week. Let's say psychologically, someone I asked, I gave it theoretical, but you can give any example. You need to smoke. The man says that if I don't smoke on Shabbos, I'm going to go out of my mind. I'm going to jump off the building. I'm going to kill myself. I need to smoke. It could be any other example of Machal Shabbos. Is that permitted because of someone's psychological difficulty? Remember what we saw with the Lakewood Rosh Hashiva. He was dealing with people who were addicted. I played it for you, the video, where he says, it doesn't matter if it's Shabbos, doesn't matter if Yom Kippur, if you need to call your sponsor, call your sponsor. You're allowed to be Machal Shabbos. Well, who says? Just because someone has a psychological issue, let's say I have a psychological issue, I feel I need to eat tarfus. There's a case in the Gemara that says a man, he needed to talk to this woman or he would die. And they say, no, we're not going to let the Benosi Sherol Hefker. So we'll get into this answer. How much of a psychological danger to someone's self, even maybe danger to life, does that allow you then to violate Shabbos? If someone says that, I just can't take it anymore. I'm going crazy. I've been locked up all these months. I need to turn on the television tonight. It's Friday night, right? I mean, when are you allowed, if at all? And as I said, but the main part of this response is going to be, what does the Rambam mean when he says that certain averos are worse than murder? If it's not the three big ones, what could be worse than murder? And so we'll get back to that next class. And I think also next class, we will finish this one. We're going to deal with the Kloisenberger Rebbe, introduce you to a new figure, a very significant, a very interesting figure who, especially when he went to Eretz Yisrael, but and also a terrible situation he had in the war. I'll tell you about his biography and maybe that really can explain some of the difficult things he says. And then more good stuff. But we're up to page 264 now, and the book is 371 pages. So we still have time. Okay, I'm going to thank you all. Let me take the questions here, the chat. No mass. Susanna says no mass. No. In Israel, what they do with the yeshivas now is that everyone came in and they were in pods and they all got corona. That didn't work. My son has corona. The people you see there, most of them have corona, but had, but they keep them separate. There's two groups, and the groups that are together, they're allowed to be together and they're under lockdown. So it's very unlikely that the few people who don't have it will get it, because they're with people who have it and no one's going out. But if you notice, one of the Rosh Yeshiva, the one playing the guitar, the Rosh Yeshiva plays the guitar, but he's in the box. And all the Rebbeim who come in, they're in these enclosed boxes that are enclosed on top also. When they first began the year, they were not enclosed on top, but everything's enclosed. So, but not the students. It's the best thing this year. The students who are in Israel this year and all the yeshivas, they're able to have, the only thing they can't do is go to people's houses for Shabbos, which is an important part of the year, but at least they can have a normal yeshiva experience. So David says, Rosh Yeshiva Bini Freem is a Talmud of Lichtenstein. Yes, he is. Although he's not, he's more into the Hasidic side. I don't know where he got that from, because he didn't get it from Lichtenstein. He's very much into the heart. They have other Rosh Yeshiva. Yitzi Blau is also Rosh Yeshiva there. And I'm not saying that Bini Freeman doesn't have the head also, but he leads the Kumsitz every Thursday night. And really, he's very good in terms of touching students. Yes, Rabbi Kalman says music and davening was reform. And indeed, it was reform, 100%. Yes, Shlomo Karlbach did it. And they do it for Slichos. But in the middle of Shachris davening, it's a Karlbachy thing, exactly. Howard says correctly, Naftali, music exists in the Beis Hamikdash, Shashira Slavim with Karbanos. That becomes the big issue when the reformers start. What's wrong with music? And how are you saying, why can't we have music? And on Shabbos, why can't we have it on Shabbos? A non-Jew plays it. But that's the Beis Hamikdash. That's not in shuls. There's no halachic problem, but the question is, are you imitating the non-Jews and you do it? Today, I don't think anyone's, because the reform don't use organs today anyway, do they? So no one's going to raise an issue, I think. Naftali says the nigunim for the piyutim, minagei meral, re the issue of the chazan changing nigun for vaka vedor. Okay, not sure what you meant by that. Yes, eshmara shabbat. This is exactly the eshmara shabbat. It's Sephardic. I didn't know Sephardic. So if it's Sephardic, then we know where it comes from. It either comes from the Ottoman Empire, or it comes from Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael was part of the Ottoman Empire. I wasn't sure if it was Sephardic or not. Tenderloin is from the front part of the cow. Susanna says, okay, but in the video and the picture I showed you, it showed it from the back part of the cow. You saw the picture I showed you. Do I still have it here? No, I closed it. Here it is. Susanna, I don't know anything about cows, but there you have in the back. There's the tenderloin. There's the sirloin. And I believe that real tenderloin we can eat. In America, you can't get it anywhere. They have, it's like fake tenderloin. That's what I'm told. I don't like steak and meat. If I go to the steakhouses, I get chicken. So I, someone's sound is on. If you could turn it off. Chaim says our Rav was at the Kotel and a chassid's phone began ringing the tune of Jingle Bells. It was clear he had no idea what it was. Yes, that is strange. Yes, the sciatic nerve. Okay, you have to remove to get an usher. Yeah. Okay, that was, you were asking before I got to it. Susanna says it's too expensive to remove it. It is very expensive. You saw what the prices are of that meat. But Zev says, don't try porridge in the official Scrabble tournament or club. It will get challenged off. Why will it get challenged off? It's in the dictionary. It's in the major dictionaries. I looked online. In all the big dictionaries, it's there. That should make it a good word.
It's acceptable in Collins, which is used all over the world, but it's not acceptable in North American Scrabble.
Okay, you're a Scrabble person. Yeah, but the word comes from England.
Scrabble champion.
Okay. Champion. But now my question is, it should be, though. It's an English word. It's a word.
It should.
Yeah, okay. The anti-Semites over at the Scrabble people, what can you do? We got to do something like that. David says, apropos secular songs in the Kol of a Rebbe, a group of snarky American yeshiva students attended a Tisha Kalev in B'nai Brak and talked to Rebbe and his Hasidim Anu Nigun, which is actually the musical interlude of My Angel is a Centerfold. No. And the Rebbe is reported as saying, Das ist a starke Nigun in the mid-1980s. You know what? Everything has holy sparks. So if they want to raise that up, they can raise that up also. I told you already months ago that the Chabad in the 80s, the Chabad house in Rutgers was singing the old, you can see it on YouTube, bum, bum, bumblebee, bumblebee, tuna. They were die, 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 die. And the Chabad people, of course, had no idea what that was, but that was the nigun. Baruch points out, in pre-ubiquitous internet days, letter writing was a common pastime. You're correct. And I sort of imagine myself, and as I said, from the very first class, if you remember, as this republic of letters. And as a historian, if you've seen my Weinberg book, you know that it couldn't have been written the way it was, certainly not the last chapter, without all the letters. And I've published many letters, and much as my research is done with letters, I wonder what are future historians going to do? Because who writes letters? So fine, the president and other important people, they give their hard drive to some library. But most of us write emails, and after we're gone, it disappears. How will we be able to write history? How will we be able to know what the people were thinking? So I don't know. It's going to be a problem. The letters is what enables us to write so many important things about history and all world history, American history, the study biography. They all depend on private letters. And as I said, we had this republic of letters in the Jewish world as well. The Girsa of the Rambam, if you open up your Mishnah Torah, it says V'lo mechachmehem, but the other Girsa, it says Ela mechachmehem. So it's a question. David Eisen's, which is the correct Girsa? David says, did Elie Wiesel have any issues with Moshe Klein's anti-Zionism? Elie Wiesel was together with Menashe Klein in Buchenwald, and later Menashe Klein was in Auschwitz. Also with Elie Wiesel, after the war, they took very different lessons. The issue isn't so much with the anti-Zionism. Menashe Klein is not an anti-Zionist. He took his lands for Kiryat Ungvar from the Zionists. He's like a non-Zionist. He's really not anti-Zionist in the sense you think of Satmar. But what was the lesson that Elie Wiesel took from the Holocaust? It's that we have, with all this hate, we have to create love. And Elie Wiesel's entire life was about love. And yet if in Kiryat Ungvar, the Beis Medrash is named after Elie Wiesel's murdered family, I think in particular his father. And Elie Wiesel was a big financial backer of Menashe Klein. And I only met Elie Wiesel once, and I didn't have the heart to mention this to him. But one day, if I knew him, I wanted to say, do you know what your money, that you're such a humanist and believer in spreading of love, that your friend Menashe Klein, that some of the things he's teaching is in direct opposition? He's not teaching the love of all people. He's teaching like a contempt of non-Jews that was very much opposed to Elie Wiesel. So I never asked Elie Wiesel that, because I only met him once. It's very striking that Menashe Klein took a very different lesson from the war. The lesson was that you can't trust the non-Jews, even if a non-Jew is being nice to you, really just give him a chance and they'll slit your throat, and that we have to keep to ourselves and we want nothing to do with the non-Jews. Elie Wiesel's lesson was just the exact opposite, that we have to learn from hatred and we have to try to stop it wherever we are, wherever it is. And Baruch points out Rabbi Klein was not Satmar, he was connected to Kloisenberg. Ellen says natural law versus Torah, maybe killing, stealing, but Arayot seems to be a weak point regardless. Well, when you speak about Arayos, we're speaking about incest, we're speaking about adultery, it's homosexuality. Those are regarded traditionally as being a natural law. Today, I think the move is to say it's not natural law. That, for example, homosexuality is usher, but only because of the Torah commands it. But we can imagine, people have it, that's their inclination. So it's not natural law. I think that would make sense today. People would have a different perspective. Many people would, at least, but classically, arayos were included in, incest is one of the Shev Mitzvos. Whether you know about it or not, it's one of the Shev Mitzvos in Noach. I mean, Rabbi Klein doesn't say that whether you don't know about it. He says that only if you do the things because of God that you have a share in the world to come, but you still are sinning even if you never heard about the Torah. Because they're natural. Rabbi Kelman says, the Torah says, if you own money, and the Maharal explains, the Torah writes, that we should give tzedakah because we want to, not because we have to. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg writes about this as well. He says there's no bracha on tzedakah. And he develops the notion that because it's supposed to come internally, we're supposed to want to do it, it's not a command. Maybe, my connection to YCT from years ago, but no, it's not YCT, believe me. And yeah, because I asked him, he thought that it was JTS. Why Manahao? I don't know. Is a Jesuit university better than JTS? Yes, the Jesuit university is better than JTS. Because a Jesuit university, I'm a Jew in a Jesuit university. What do I have to do with that? It's a non-Jewish institution. But when you're with the seminary, you're involved, you could say, with an institution that's in opposition to Torah law. So Baruch said he meant JTS, not YCT. Not Rabbi Greenberg, Patach. It's Rabbi Mazuz. Patach is, as I said, Professor Talmud Chacham. So I'm a professor. Talmud Chacham, not, I would say, but not according to, obviously, the level of the people we're dealing with here. Howard says, was Rav Aaron Kuker a brother-in-law to Shaul Lieberman, married to sister's daughters, or Rissa Meltzer? No. Rav Aaron Kuker has no relationship to Shaul Lieberman. Rav Shaul Lieberman was the first cousin of the Chazon Ish. Their mothers were sisters. Rav Aaron Kuker was the son-in-law of Rav Yisrael Meltzer, but he was not Rav Shaul Lieberman, and nothing to do with Rav Yisrael Meltzer. Rav Yisrael Meltzer had other Talmidei Chachamim who were sons-in-law. And Rav Shach is also not a, Rav Shach is a nephew. Barry says, Shaul Lieberman was married to the daughter of Mayor Berlin, the granddaughter of the Mitziv. Yes, many people will point it out. Yes, they're all related to. Nat Lewin asked, my wife asked now, she wondered why Rav Moshe Klein signed his name as Menashe HaKatan? Because Nat Klein in German, Yiddish, is Katan. So remember saying, signing Rav Moshe Klein is like Menashe HaKatan. Just like Sofer is Schreiber. Moshe Schreiber and Moshe Sofer are the same thing. Sofer, the writer, is Schreiber. Ah, I see Mel already pointed it out in Alan. Thank you. But it's a sign. It's also a sign of humility, as David says. People often will write, you know, so and so Hakatan. But with Menashe Klein, it's not just a sign of humility; it's actually his name. A couple more. David Eisen says, when Shlomo Roth, while indeed identified with the religious Zionism, was also very opposed to the conservative movement, and accordingly refused to accept the Rav Kook Prize when it was awarded together with Rav Shaul Lieberman. That is correct, and you can read all about that in Shaul Lieberman and the Orthodox. But I also say that this. Meshulam Roth didn't know Shaul Lieberman personally. If he knew him personally, he might have had a different approach to that. And I give an example, because if you look in the Kol Mavaser, there's a letter from Meshulam Roth to Adolf Schwartz. Adolf Schwartz, who wrote this book on the Gzeirah Shava, he taught at the Rabbinical Seminary of Vienna. The Rabbinical Seminary of Vienna was not an Orthodox institution. It was the conservative institution, what we would call conservative. And Meshulam Roth had no problems sending a tshuva to this man and being friends with him. So, I don't know. Nat Lewin says, any precedent for other respected Rabbonim converting their family name in this matter? He didn't really convert the family name. It's just in his writing, he calls himself Menashe HaKatan. If you look on if you turn the book over, the title page, it has his real name. His name is Klein. But in Hebrew, Klein is just the translation of HaKatan. So he'd write with it. Do any others write? Well, most people. Well, Steinsaltz, doesn't Steinsaltz? Didn't he turn his name into in Israel? You have a lot of the people who turn their name into Hebrew. What did Steinsaltz call himself? He started using a Hebrew term for his name.
Evan Yisrael.
So yes, we have examples of that as well. David, I'm machaving to David. David knows a lot, and so we're machaving together. Thank you. Moshe shows over. Rabbi Mel mentions Rabbi Rakefet. I mentioned him the end of last class. I recommended everyone. I said go to YouTube. I meant YU Torah. You can on the Wikipedia page. You can get the link to his shiurim on Hesped for Joe DiMaggio. And it is true what Mel says. Rabbi Rakefet has COVID. As far as I know. At the moment, everything is okay. So we pray that that will be the case. Three more things here. Someone privately emails in the Mariel, it attributes the death of his daughter to his once changing the cantillation of a portion he read in a particular city. That's not really relevant. That's a private thing. Sorry for reading it. Yeah. Ellen says adultery is a weak spot for people of all stripes, regardless of other Torah observance. Granted, but that's not the issue. The issue is, can you figure out on your own that adultery is incorrect and wrong? And we see that societies all over the world recognize that it's wrong. So I know you might point to some societies that didn't think it's wrong, but it was always understood that that was regarded as a as something basic. If non-Jews are commanded in it, the standard position is that it's natural law, that it's something you should be able to conclude on your own. Because otherwise, what sense does it make to command people who don't have the Torah? Thank you, Naftali. Yoel Katan, the editor of the journal Hamayan, whose father was from France, who did the dictionary of French into old laws, old French in Rashi. The name is Klein, but his name is now, and not just his name, the entire family in Israel took the name Katan. But the Hakatan is he's combining the name with the modest. I don't think if his name was Klein, he wasn't Klein, he would have said Hakatan. Baruch says the Lubavitch Rebbe instructed Steinsaltz to do that, but it should be Melech Evan. Okay. So it's not really a translation. Okay, everyone. Well, thank you. Howard ends by saying usually the Hebrew is not descriptive for the last name. We have other examples. I'll just give you one and then we'll end. Friedman, the name Friedman. So you have big scholars, Meir Friedman. He published various Midrashim. In Hebrew, this is for you, Nat. In Hebrew, he didn't write the name Meir Friedman. He wrote the name Ish Shalom. Friedman Ish Shalom. And there's other examples where I can't think of any offhand where these academic scholars, Cecil Roth, in one of his essays that he wrote in Hebrew, he wrote very little in Hebrew, but he signs it Min HaEdomim. It's like Azariah de Rossi, he calls him Roth from Red, he signs it Min HaEdomim. So you have a number, I'll think of it when we finish now, I'll think of all the others, but it's a common thing that you'll find among the Wissenschaft type scholars when they write in Hebrew, they Hebraicize their names. Okay. Thank you all for coming out with us tonight.
Thank you. It's good to know because my mother was a Friedman.
Baruch says Ben Sasson is also a Friedman. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. I have to find out if anybody in the family has done that. I don't think so. My uncle made Aliyah. He's still Friedman. Anyways, okay. Thank you.
Oh, it's different between Freudman and Friedman. Freude is joy and Frieda is peace.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Spelled in Hebrew is a whole other thing.
Thank you very much. Thank you always. We look forward to seeing.